In today's gospel passage from Mark, we find Jesus traveling south towards Jerusalem. And he's passing through Galilee, where he announces his passion and resurrection for the second time. Once again, the disciples misunderstand the message of Jesus and his purpose. They question the behaviors of someone who follows through on the message and actions of Jesus, even though they do not profess to follow him. I think it's worthwhile here to remind ourselves who the disciples were. Remind ourselves that Jesus did not go to the temple to find his team, to select his closest associates. He didn't select his mentorees from the intelligentsia. He didn't look to the rabbis or the priestly class to select those who would carry the message of him and his father. No, Jesus went to and selected common men. His crew was made up of fishermen, a tax collector, a zealot, and a thief. Why Jesus selected such a group of ragtag misfits is a mystery. One theory is that he wanted a group of men who had blank slates when it came to theology. There's no indication that any of them had any knowledge of, and therefore any prejudice against, things of spiritual, religious, or theological nature. Jesus was working with a group that would not challenge his religious ideas. Another explanation, and I think this was far more reasonable, is that Jesus was simply drawn to those who were simple and uncomplicated. Jesus was simply drawn to the very kinds of people most of us spend our time trying to avoid: the sick, the poor, the tired, the powerless. Perhaps Jesus selected this crew because he wanted his inner circle to look like the people he came to serve. He wanted his apostles to be able to meet the people where they were. One of my points of pride at the Open Hearth is that the staff reflects the clients. Our 35 staff are made up of men and women who are recovering from drugs, alcohol, and other forms of mental illness. We have been to jail, to psych hospitals, and substance abuse treatment centers. When one of the men at the Open Hearth is confronted by a staff member, the likelihood is high that the staff member shares the client's disease and background. It's kind of hard to look into the eyes of a man who did 35 years for murder and see there's no point in my trying to get a job and do what's right. It's possible. The deck is stacked against ex-cons. So given who Jesus was inclined to help, it makes sense he chose to be his disciples, his teachers, his apostles. Send common people out to preach to common people. Send out a thief to change a thief. Send out a selfish, self-centered tax collector to teach compassion and selflessness. Send out fishermen to attract common men and women. Whatever the reason, it's clear that disciples, despite their best efforts, often were confused by Jesus' message. They often get it wrong, as they did in this instance. They seem to think that helping people, that healing the sick, should be reserved for people who explicitly follow Jesus. Jesus makes it clear to them, and he makes it clear to us, that righteousness is not reserved for the people of Jesus. The disciples were anticipating that Jesus would reject a person that was doing what he was preaching, but had not sworn loyalty to him. Waging a battle against Satan, demons, and unclean spirits is a central theme for Mark. Here Jesus is clear that anybody, anywhere that joins the cause is an ally of ours. It matters not who or what they declare allegiance to. If they are in the fight to help people, they are one of us. Indeed, if they are not against us, they are for us. Jesus is saying that don't get hung up in artificial, superficial differences. Whether you call yourself a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, or an agnostic does not matter. If you give a thirsty person a cup of water, it will quench their thirst, no matter whose name you offer it in. And the reward for offering that water will be the same no matter. And Jesus throws in another little curve. He says, no one who does a deed of power in my name will be able soon afterward to speak evil of me. In AA, we call that fake it till you make it. That is, come in and do what we do. Say what we say, even if you don't believe it. Just say it. Act like you love other alcoholics, even if you don't. Treat others with dignity and respect, even if you feel hypocritical doing it. Treat yourself as though you were a child of God, even if you don't feel it. And before you know it, you will be believing it. you will internalize these principles. You will accept these things as truth. Jesus is telling his disciple, if people start acting like us and talking like us, soon they will be like us. Soon they will be one of us. And even if they do not become one of us, they will not be against us. I'm going to take this opportunity to point something out here, something I think is very important, something I think does not get talked enough about in Christian communities, and that is Jesus' love and compassion for the mentally ill. I don't think we really appreciate the importance that he gave to addressing the pain of the mentally ill. Jesus has a special place in his heart for those who are victims of a disease that causes them to be ostracized, to be ignored and looked down upon. You see, in antiquity, they didn't have the DSM. The DSM is the official name, is a Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It is the handbook used by healthcare professionals in the United States and in much of the world as the authoritative guide to the diagnosis of mental disorders. In other words, it is the place that lists many of the different mental health diagnoses. So in Jesus' day, they wouldn't call you a schizophrenic. They would say you were possessed by demons. They wouldn't call you bipolar. They would say you had unclean spirits. So whenever you read that Jesus was driving out unclean spirits or demons, read that he was healing the mentally ill. Read that as Jesus showing compassion for people who lack control for what they're doing. Read that as Jesus rejecting and driving out the disease, but loving the person. And if you profess to follow the teachings and modelings of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, you can do no less. The focus of today's passage is helping a man who is helping a victim of mental illness. The very first public act of Jesus' ministry was casting out the unclean spirit of the man of the synagogue in Capernaum. That is, Jesus' very first public healing was healing a victim of mental illness. The man who preceded Jesus, the man who announced his coming, the man who had the privilege and honor of baptizing Jesus was himself mentally ill and was an outcast. John the Baptist was a bizarre figure who lived on the outskirts of town in the woods. He just dressed differently and ate odd things. If Jesus came this afternoon and was to be baptized, let me tell you that he wouldn't be baptized at Christ Church Cathedral in downtown. And the baptism would not be officiated by a bishop wearing fine vestments. No, my Jesus would be baptized by some ostracized nut wearing stained, worn, unsightly clothing. The baptizer would emerge from under I-91, and he would baptize Jesus in the Connecticut River. And the crowds that stood around to witness the baptism would not be made up of the ruling class finally dressed and appointed. Those standing around would be my people, the nuts, the drunks, the crooks, and the junkies, the friends and associates of the man who did the baptizing. Jesus' affinity for the mentally ill and the outcast is clear and consistent. But let me also be clear about something else. Loving and caring for folks that suffer from mental illness is not always an easy thing to do. I do not pretend that it is. It is not always easy to separate the illness from the person. And often we must protect ourselves from their behaviors of the mentally ill, no matter the source. A knife-wielding man is a threat to others' safety, no matter his mental status. And often there's a very thin line between having compassion for a mentally ill person and enabling the disease. Striking that balance is often very difficult. Loving a person in active addiction can often mean locking them out of the house despite their pleas to come in. The loving thing to do for a mentally ill person can often mean leaving them in the hospital behind locked doors despite their tears, fears, and feelings of abandonment and rejection. Do not think that my plea to love and understand the mentally ill means accepting everything we dish out. What it means is that we love them through their struggles and their difficulties, just as you would love any other ill person. And Jesus does not call us to love and embrace the mentally ill because it is easy. This passage closes with Jesus' admonition that salt is good, but if salt has lost its saltiness, how can a person season it? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. As Episcopalians, we have a beautiful liturgy. Our music can at times be magnificent. Our ceremonies can sometimes capture every sense we have, touch, smell, and hearing. For us, it is important to us what colors are dominant, what robes we wear, and when. We know or debate which vestments are appropriate for each and every conceivable occasion. We have rules about what candles are lit and when. We are clear as to our roles, what a lay person can do and say, what a deacon can read, what ceremonies a priest can perform, and what requires the hands of a bishop. Our buildings are often magnificent structures, challenging the majesty of all buildings around them. I do not mock any of these things. On the contrary, I love them, but they are the salt. If that is all we are, we have lost our saltiness. If that is all we are, we have lost our flavor. What gives us meaning and purpose is our saltiness. What gives us spice and taste is that we love, is that we free the captives, feed the hungry, love our neighbor, visit those who are in prison. I dearly miss being inside our little church on Main Street. Assisting Denise at the table touches my heart in ways I cannot describe. Preaching from that pulpit and looking directly at you reminds me of the responsibility I assume when I preach, and thus, as ironic as it may seem, it strengthens my sense of humility. Seeing, touching, and hearing you in the flesh is deeply moving for me, but all that is really the salt. Understanding and living out the meaning of the ceremony performed at the table is the saltiness. Acting out in the world what I preach from the pulpit is the saltiness. Being there for you when you need me, no matter where, is the saltiness. St. James, I love you. I need you, and the world needs your saltiness. The world does not need your salt. That is for you. The world desperately needs your saltiness. That is for Jesus.